I guess last Tuesday, I sort of stopped at showing that given a pair of probability measures on Rn, there exists a joint measure with these given fellows as they're marginal, such that actually a little more than this, if gamma has its support cyclically monotone, so in other words contained in the subdifferential of psi with psi convex, then is actually equal to the maximum that it can be. And this is also equal to the integral of psi against the left marginal plus the integral of psi star against the right marginal. And both of these things converge. Ah, well, there were some hypotheses. To show that there exists a psi whose subdifferential contains support gamma, we don't need these hypotheses. Right, and also to show that there exists such a gamma. But if you want to show that it actually achieves this maximum, okay. Yeah. So now going back 2 weeks. So 2 weeks ago, I tried to show something like this. There exists gamma with cyclically monotone support. And this didn't use any hypothesis on the mu and nu. Right. So this is without hypotheses on mu and nu. And then, if you want to talk about this variational problem, then it's helpful to have some kind of limits on the growth of mu and nu at infinity. Yes. Absolutely. Yep. So this maximum, let's see. So I think for the statement here, it's probably sufficient. So this is an exercise. I claim that it's enough the hypotheses can be replaced by a the existence of some f and g, which way am I going? So this, I can probably let plus infinity be a value. Some f and g satisfying this, for all x and y in Rn cross Rn with integral f d nu less than infinity and integral f g d nu less than infinity. So I think that you can relax these hypotheses to these hypotheses here if you're only interested in this problem. On the other hand, if you're interested in this problem, which is the same as this problem here, then you really want these two things to be integrable against the left and right marginal here. So this is equal, provided that I have the second moment condition. So somehow for this maximum to be equivalent to this minimum, I really want these numbers to be finite. And for that, I really want the second moment to exist. Matt?
So the product of the y might not be integrable?
Right. Sure. It might, it might be that it diverges in both the plus infinity and minus infinity directions. And you don't actually need it to be integrable, but what you do need is that it's integrable above, and this sort of gives that to you. So the positive part of it should be integrable. Other questions?
So, hopefully the last question would be, so if we get the first problem, the next problem is actually milder than, doesn't affect the moment.
Yep. I'm sorry, you say this minimum exists, but this one doesn't.
Yeah, that's okay. So I just wondered if you know maybe what is the optimal set of data for which the minimization problem
to be. I guess the short answer is no.
Or maybe not optimal, but wider than with these conditions.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to say about that. So there are sort of two things that I wanted to do. I wanted to tell you, first of all, it was part of this theorem that we showed on Tuesday that actually psi is L1 integrable with respect to mu. And since the condition of being cyclically monotone if S is cyclically monotone, then S star is as well, where, you know, interchanging Y and X. Let's see, it should be S star will be contained in the subdifferential of this guy, it should follow from the same argument that psi star is in L1 of B nu. So what I wanted to say is this is actually a special case of a general duality theorem, which says, so what we've actually shown is something like the maximum of gamma tilde in nu nu integral xy to gamma tilde is equal to the infimum, or even the minimum, so somehow there's something that's very obvious here, which is that whenever I take a pair of functions u and v which satisfy this inequality, their sum is bigger than the inner product between x and y, and a measure gamma tilde, which has marginals mu and nu, it's pretty straightforward that you have an implication like this. So that the maximum over all such measures has to be less than the minimum over all such functions. And what we've actually proved is that they're equal to each other. And this is a special case, case of a general duality relationship, of a more general so I want to replace the inner product by some general cost on Rn cross Rn. And this minimization it's the same kind of minimization, except the constraint on the functions u and v is that their sum at a pair of points x and y should be bigger than the cost function. In fact, so to keep my own sanity, I better make this a minimization and this a maximization. So it's more in the form of this problem rather than that problem up there. And so this is, let's say, Kantorovich duality. It's also the duality theorem from linear programming. And one direction of this thing is obvious, namely, notice any pair of functions, any gamma tilde with given marginals and pair of functions u and v. Such that u of x plus v of y is less than c of xy satisfy if I integrate this against gamma tilde, then I get something like this. And if I use the fact that the marginals of gamma are given by mu and nu, and I get something like that. And if I don't worry about these sort of questions about convergence, of whether I can really break this thing up, then it's clear that for each U and V, this is true for all, for all gamma tilde, and so it's true taking a minimum over gamma tilde with marginals mu and nu. And since this holds for all U and V, I can equally well take a maximum over all U and V. And so this this direction here is supposed to be pretty plausible. And what's a little bit remarkable about these problems is that the soup actually equals them in under enough hypotheses that everything can be defined. Okay, so there's sort of two things I want to do today. One is that I want to talk about this more general kind of duality relationship here of which we've established a special instance. And I want to cast that into the framework of two-player zero-sum games. And the other thing that I want to do is that I still owe you a proof from the previous lecture of the fact that if I'm in this situation here, and I'm sorry, I'm not following the part about the product and the sum. So it can be either way. If I make this a max and this a min, then I need to reverse the direction of this inequality. Right here, this inequality was going the other way around. So it's just that I'm more accustomed to thinking about minimizing costs that I write it in this way. But if you replace C and U and V by the negative of C and the negative of U and the negative of V, then you'll come back to this form. And the only difference is this inequality will turn around. Other questions? Okay. So this is sort of the main thing I want to talk about today. However, I do owe you a proof, which was that if I'm in the situation where this theorem applies, or these conditions, or whatever, then there was one additional fact. I still claimed that if port gamma is contained in a convex subdifferential and gamma and mu nu as above, then mu absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue measure. So sometimes I'll write that as Hausdorff n-dimensional measure on Rn, and sometimes I'll write it as volume. It implies that gamma can actually be realized as the image of the measure mu under a mapping that takes Rn to R2n. Namely, this mapping here. And so, so this I owe you proof for. And so let me start by, I'm going to need the set of points where the convex function psi is finite. And this is a convex set. satisfy the convex potential. And I also need the set of points where psi is differentiable. And what I know about these sets are the following things. First of all, since Psi is integrable with respect to mu, it had better be finite on a set of full measure. So and so support mu is contained in the closure of the convex set where Psi is finite. And secondly, it's a general fact about convex functions that the set omega naught will be convex. The convex function will be locally Lipschitz in the interior of this convex set. And so Rademacher's theorem implies that that the volume of the set of points in omega where psi is not differentiable is zero. And moreover, the difference between a convex set and its boundary is also a set of measure zero. And so so basically what this tells me is that the since all points and since mu is absolutely continuous with respect to volume, that means that this set has measure zero. And since all of the mass of mu is contained in this set, that says that, therefore, gradient psi exists in mu almost everywhere. Well, Rademacher also says gradient of psi is a, since psi is a continuous function, gradient of psi is a Borel map. And that means this mapping here, it's actually not defined on all of Rn, it's defined on omega 1, but it's defined on a big enough set to push forward the measure mu to get a new probability measure. So, a Borel probability measure. Let's call it gamma tilde. It's therefore well defined. And it's a joint measure on Rn cross Rn. And we want to see that it agrees with the given measure gamma. Claim. So I want to prove this. It's enough to check this on rectangles, U cross V product for sets in Rn. And I want to use the fact that so there are sort of two interesting sets for us. There's the subdifferential, which contains the supportive gamma, and there's the graph of the gradient, which is, of course, contained in the subdifferential. And moreover, I claim both of these sets are full measure for gamma. Because the difference between these two sets is contained in this set here, the set of points where psi is not differentiable but still in the closure of the set where psi is finite, and gamma of this set. Is mu of this set, which we just argued was zero. So this has full mass for gamma. This has full mass for gamma because it differs from this by a set of measure zero. And so now I'm in a position to check the equality we want. Gamma of the set U cross V is gamma of U cross V intersect G, because G is a set of full measure for gamma. And that's basically the set of... So this consists of a set of points from G, which means it points to the form X gradient C of X, such that X is in omega 1, X had also better be in U, and this point here had better be in V. So that's the set that I'm looking at. But this can also be written as a condition on X, namely, and the only condition on Y is that it be gradient of X, which is to say that I'm in G. And so this is... But G is a set of zero measure. I mean, it's a set of full measure for gamma, so I can drop this condition without changing anything. Maybe I better do that. And so now this is a condition on X only. gradient inverse V intersect U intersect omega 1, and Y can be anything. And so that's a condition on mu. Or because the left marginal of gamma is mu and Y is arbitrary here, and I don't even bother about omega 1 because the only point from the preimage of the gradient line omega 1. But this is actually, this is more or less the definition of gamma tilde, right? Gamma tilde was defined to be a push forward of this map, this measure here through this mapping, and which means that gamma tilde of a product UV is the set of all, is mu of the set of all X such that the map takes values in U cross V, and that's what we have here. So gamma and gamma tilde are the same thing. And you can actually use this fact to show uniqueness with a little bit of a fudge. So with a result that I stated earlier but didn't prove, I can conclude uniqueness in this theorem under this hypothesis. So moreover, I sketch a uniqueness proof rapidly. A proof of uniqueness. Suppose there were two. So I sketch a uniqueness proof and I use the second moment conditions. So proof of uniqueness. The theorem is true without the second moment conditions, but the proof that I want to sketch depends on the second moment conditions. Otherwise, you need to use something more like the geometric maximum principle of Alexandrov, which John has started to describe. Okay. So under the second moment conditions on mu and nu, suppose gamma 1 and gamma 0 both have cyclically monotone support. Then, according to this story up here, both maximize. Both achieve this maximum here. And since this maximization problem is a linear functional of gamma tilde in a convex set capital gamma, that means any linear combination of these two guys also maximize. as does the convex combination hand, the result that I stated once but didn't prove is that when you have a maximizer to this problem, it also has cyclically monotone support. Because otherwise, there would be some more efficient way to pair the points, the x's with the y's in this measure, which would increase the cost. I mean, increase the whatever we're trying to maximize. So, a perturbation, general perturbations. So gamma 1/2 cannot be maximal unless it too has cyclically monotone support. Which by Rockefeller's theorem says there must be some convex function associated to gamma 1/2. Containing the subdifferential of this this measure here. And so therefore, now, any set on which gamma 0 is non-zero is a set on which gamma 1/2 is non-zero. And therefore, the support of gamma I is contained in the support of gamma 1/2, which is contained in psi for both I equals 0 and 1. So both gamma 0 and gamma 1 have their support contained in the subdifferential of the same convex function. And what we proved in the claim at the top of the board was so both gamma 0 and gamma 1 are equal to this measure here. And therefore, gamma 0 equals gamma 1. So why is the support of gamma 0 contained in the support of gamma 1/2? So a point is in the support of a measure if and only if every neighborhood around that point has positive mass under the measure. And if I have a point for which every neighborhood has positive mass under gamma 0, then it must have at least as much, it must have at least half as much mass under gamma 1/2, and so it also has positive mass for gamma 1/2. Other questions? So actually, somehow, here we proved uniqueness of two different things, depending on what starting point you choose in this proof. We proved uniqueness of the measure with given marginals that have cyclically monotone support, and we also proved uniqueness of the maximizer of this linear functional on this set, because if I take any two maximizers, then starting at this point in the proof, I get uniqueness. I somehow want to change gears completely, and I want to motivate this general duality principle from the point of view of two-player zero-sum games. And so this theory was partly worked out by Nash, and I guess partly by von Neumann, and this was the subject of the film A Beautiful Mind, right? This was when he's going around talking about finding the governing dynamics all the time. This is what he was talking about. or at least this was a beginning point, a symbol case that could be worked out. And it's also what we tend to teach our economics undergraduates and graduate students. So a two-player zero-sum game is one in which there are two players that have strategies available to player one and player two. And the set of strategies might be, it might be a finite set, it might be an infinite set. So I will start out with the simplest case where player one has M strategies available. And actually, these are often represented as the unit vectors along an orthogonal basis for Rm. And the strategies available to player two I'll take n discrete strategies again, but for later use, I will identify them with the with an orthogonal basis for Rn. And then there's a payoff function on F cross T, and it equals the amount player one has to pay to player two. If player one plays strategy S and player two plays strategy T. If let's say player one playing strategy S winds up paying to player two if the latter plays strategy T. So it's a zero-sum game because whatever player two loses, player one loses, player two wins, and vice versa. And there's a general fact about these games, which is that it's a disadvantage if you're forced to admit your strategy to your opponent. And so if player two is if player one is forced to admit that he's going to play strategy F naught, then player two will maximize over his available strategies and pay off if player one is forced to declare . And of course, player one doesn't want to pay any more than he has to. So if he's forced to admit his strategy first, he will try to minimize this payoff. Declare his strategy first.
And similarly,
if player 2 is forced to declare his strategy to player 1 before player 1 selects the strategy, then player 1 is going to choose the strategy which minimizes the payoff. So he'll do something like this. Let me forget the not. I'm not sure I want the not in there. And so if player 2 knows he's going to be declared to force the strategy first, he would still like to get to win as much in this game as possible. So he'll look at the outcome given that he chooses strategy T, and he'll try to maximize over that those strategies. So it's pretty clear that there should be an inequality here which says that it's a disadvantage to be forced to admit your strategy to your opponent. And that inequality says that player 2 will not do as well in this game, or can't do any better in this game if he's forced to admit his strategy to his opponent than player 1 would do. So this inequality captures the fact that it's a disadvantage to be forced to admit your strategy. Or declaring one's strategy places one at a disadvantage. And this inequality is true with no structural assumptions on P or on the sets S and T. It's a terribly general thing. And so, on the other hand, one of the things that Nash was looking for was an equilibrium. And so there's this notion, which is a Nash equilibrium. Which is a pair of strategies, that's not T-naught, which may or may not exist. It's a pair of strategies, that's not T-naught, such that neither player can improve his situation by unilaterally changing his strategy. What's equivalent is to say that player 1 would like the payoff to be as little as possible, and so if player 1 chooses his strategy, the payoff should only go up. And player 2 would like his winnings to be as much as possible, and so for this to be a Nash equilibrium, if player 2 changes his strategy, his winnings should only go down. And so that's, if such a pair of strategies exist, it's called a Nash equilibrium. It's also it's a sort of saddle point for the function P, because it sort of says, in the S variable, I'm at a minimum, and in the T variable, I'm at a maximum. It corresponds to a saddle point. And then the question was asked, can you, for what kind of games can you expect such an equilibrium to exist? And by the way, if you have the existence of such an equilibrium is a sufficient condition for equality here. So, existence of such a strategy. Implies that that it doesn't matter who declares their strategy first in the game, that the outcome will be the same, and the order of the ints in the soup can be interchanged. Because so starting from the saddle condition, P of S naught T is less than P of S naught T naught, which is less than P of S T naught for all S and T. So certainly I can take a soup over T here and still have something less than that. And I can take an inf over S here. And on the other hand, this thing here is certainly less than the supremum over all T naught and T of the ints, because it's one candidate in the supremum, and this thing here is certainly bigger than the infimum over all F naught in S. So maybe I shouldn't call it T naught, so I don't want to confuse it with the equilibrium strategy, so let me write it that way. And so if a saddle point exists, then the nth soup is less than or equal to the soup nth. And on the other hand, the nth soup is always bigger than or equal to the soup nth. And so that's where I get the equality from. So it's a sufficient condition, but not necessary, but sufficient. And so one of the things that von Neumann and Nash thought about was what kind of structure of the game can guarantee you that such an equilibrium exists. And by the way, the kind of examples that they had in mind, or at least the kind of examples that people often use of game theory, are like the penalty kick example, where you have a penalty kick in soccer, and the kicker basically needs to usually chooses between kicking to the left side of the net and the right side of the net. And so roughly the kicker has two strategies at his disposal, kick left and kick right. And the goalie has two strategies at his disposal because he really doesn't have time to wait to see where the kick is going to go. So he more or less has to decide in advance either he's going to dive left or dive right and then hope that he dives in the same direction that the kick happens. And so if you model this using a discrete strategy space with two choices for the kicker and two choices for the goalie, it's a very unstable game in the sense that if either player gets any information about what the other player is going to do, they will immediately want to change their strategy. So if player A knows that player B is going to kick right, then player A will want to dive right, but then if player B knows that player A knows that he's going to kick right, he will instead want to kick left, which causes player A to want to change his strategy, very unstable. And so what people noticed was that you can stay, so in that game there's no equilibrium strategy. because both players will instantly want to change as soon as they find out what the other guy's strategy is. But you can modify the game to create an equilibrium strategy if you allow probabilistic strategies. So this is a motivating example. And the idea is to convexify the strategy space. So you replace S by S tilde, which is the convex hull of S, and you replace T by T tilde, which is the convex hull of T, allowing mixed, so-called mixed, or probabilistic strategies. S can now be a linear combination as long as the sum of the TIs is 1. That's the condition for convexity. And we interpret such a mixed strategy as being that player 1 is going to play his different strategies with different probabilities TI, such that the TIs all sum to 1. And similarly, bad notation, lambda I. And similarly, T can play a combination of his strategies with weights, let's call it sigma I, and this time the sum of the sigma I should again be 1. And then you have to say what the payoff for a pair of mixed strategies is. And so you assume the payoff of a mixed strategy is the expected value of the payoffs of the individual strategies. So this is an assumption. I.e., you define P tilde on this larger strategy space for such a combination of pure strategies to be, this is a definition here, bilinear. So I just pull out the sums. And the observation about this motivating example was that when you do this convexification, although the original game does not have an equilibrium strategy, the new game, T tilde, on the product space S tilde cross T tilde does have an equilibrium. And so the soup inf of the convexified problem is equal to the inf soup. This is a sort of a special case of a more general theorem, which I will prove after a break. More generally, if S and T are compact convex sets, function such that P of S naught T for every S naught in S, I'm always maximizing with respect to the variable T and minimizing with respect to the variable S. So I'm maximizing with respect to T, and so this should be concave on T. And also for every T naught in T, P of S T naught is convex. If on S, the variable that I'm minimizing in, then an equilibrium strategy exists, i.e. saddle point. And as a corollary, the ESIS soup equals the M soup. Questions? So maybe we take a 5-minute break and see if they left us. Oh no, I guess T is not for another 45 minutes. So this example is a special case of this theorem because the sets S tilde and T tilde are convex and they're compact because I started out with sort of finite subsets in Rm and Rn. And the P tilde here is actually bilinear. And so in particular, not only is it convex for each fixed T, it's linear on S or affine on S. And not only is it concave for each fixed S, but it's affine on T. And so it's a bilinear function, and so it falls under the hypothesis of this theorem. I want to say a pair of topological vector spaces, and so I'm assuming continuity here, and concavity and convexity. And actually, the bad news is that in a lot of examples where you want to use this theory, you don't have maybe the compactness or something, and then or you don't have the continuity, but you have some kind of semi-continuity, and then you have to sort of either find a more general theorem or go in and do things by hand. But somehow it sort of motivates the geometry of when you can expect such things to be true. I find it very useful. Max?
When two sets are not compact, there might not exist such a problem.
Absolutely, yeah. So, as I say, it's a sufficient condition. It's certainly not necessary and sufficient. And so when you get into an example which has roughly the structure but doesn't quite satisfy the hypothesis, then you have to suffer a little bit to see whether it has the conclusion you want or not. I guess I should take off the microphone before I come into the bathroom. What's that? The zero sum means that whatever player two loses, player one wins, and vice versa. There's no way for both players to collaborate in order to do better than they would have done if they had worked against each other or something like that.
Yeah.
So is it clear? The questions? Yeah, okay. So I'll just flick the lights in case anyone else wants to come in. So it's kind of a point of some interest to me that the bit of mathematics that makes this theorem work is the same as the bit of mathematics, and somehow at the heart of the bit of mathematics that makes the Luray-Schauder fixed point theorem work, at least the Schauder part of the fixed, not the Luray part of course, but the Schauder part, which this somehow I think of this as really being a Brouwer fixed point argument, or in the case where these are infinite dimensional subsets of vector spaces via the Schauder fixed point theorem. And I'm going to prove the claim. And I'm going to first make the simplifying hypothesis that it's a little bit helpful to if you have strict convexity and strict concavity. And so let me first assume with respect to S and T separately. So maybe I should back off of my topological vector spaces back to Banach spaces or something like that, because when I want to return to the non-strictly convex case, I'm going to do it by adding a little perturbation, and I probably want to use the norm in the space to do that. So in this case, the soup is going to, so because I now have a continuous function on a compact set, the soup is going to be attained by some point that it will, of course, depend on F. And I think of it as being the best response of player 2 to player 1 strategy F. So BR stands for best response. And the strict concavity on T means that this is uniquely attained. And notice that this function is a continuous function. Right, because if Fn converges to a limit F infinity in F, then every subsequence of BR2SN has, by compactness of T, convergence sub-subsequence by compactness of T. But, from this inequality here, P of Sn Kj or whatever, T is less than P of Sn Kj, I'm sorry, what? Why does this limit exist? I haven't, so T infinity possibly depends on the subsequence. So I just say that if this is a sequence of points, given any subsequence, I can extract a sub-subsequence which has some limit, which may depend on the subsequences. Okay? But just using compactness of T, so it had better be metrizable, there's a limit of a sub-sub-sequence. And so I have this inequality for all T. So the limit J goes to infinity yields, using the continuity of P, it yields P of S infinity T is less than P of S infinity T infinity. Therefore, our subsequential limit, our limit T infinity, which may depend on the subsequence, since the best response to strategy S infinity is unique according to the strict convexity in the variable T, coincides and this is independent on the subsequence. And so this sort of says that the full sequence actually has a limit because every subsequence has a sub-subsequence which converges to this thing. And similarly, if I take an inf with respect to S of PFT, the infimum will be attained by compactness and continuity, compactness of S and continuity of P. The infimum will be attained at some point, which is the best response of player 1 to strategy T of player 2. And it's uniquely attained by the strict convexity with respect to the variable S. So, sorry, this is a minimum now. That was a maximum before. So let's say by some continuous best response function. And so now if I compose these two best response functions, so I have this mapping from T, this continuous map from T to S, and then a continuous map from S to T. So I have a continuous map from T to T where T is a compact convex set. And so I guess Schauder's fixed point theorem tells me that this has a fixed point. So Brouwer's fixed point theorem in finite dimensions and Schauder's fixed point theorem in infinite dimensions. Provides some T0 in T such that when player 2 plays strategy T0, the best response of player 2 to the best response of player 1 is again T0. So he has no incentive to change his strategy. And I claim, I claim that if I set S0 equals the best response of player 1 to T0, then S0, T0 forms a saddle. So it's a Nash equilibrium. And so let's see. So P of S0, T0 is P of best response of 1 to T0, comma T0. And because this is the best response of 1, and 1 wants the payoff to be as little as possible, this is less than P of S T0 for all S. And on the other hand, this is, since T0 is a fixed point, S0 is BR1 of, S0 comma BR2 of S0 here. And since this is the best response of player 2 to strategy S0, and player 2 wants to pay off T as large as possible, that's bigger than or equal to S0 T for all T. And so that's the proof. This is this here is BR2 of S0. So I've replaced T for that. And so that concludes the proof in the case where I have some strict convexity and strict concavity of P. And if I return to the case such as this one, where P is merely linear, then if convexity is not strict, or concavity. Sorry, what? These guys here? So in this example, they were finite. In the theorem, so the question is, what kind of vector space do I want these to be compact convex subsets of? And it's a good question, and I've been a little bit vague on that point. So let's make them compact convex subsets of a Banach space. Yeah, I think we're okay to decouple. So, I mean, of course, I'd like to let this be with respect to some weak topology. Yeah. So we can say weakly compact. I'm going to get tangled up, I can tell. So somehow what's important is that the topology of continuity of this function matches the topology of compactness of these sets. And the other thing that's important for the perturbation that I'm about to do is that the norm in the space is continuous with respect to whatever topology we have floating around. So maybe this is... So maybe I'm really doing the finite dimensional proof and I should be careful about the infinite dimensional spaces. All right. I give up. I don't want to state something that's wrong, so let me state something that I know is right. And certainly the theorem holds in more generality than finite dimensions, but I'm not so sure about the part of the proof that I'm going to do next. So if the convexity of the concavity is not strict, then you can consider instead... some little perturbation, like... So I want to make this strictly convex in S and strictly concave in T. And so I add a little bit of a norm squared of S and subtract a little bit of a norm squared of T. And I now have something which is strictly convex in both cases. Actually, I'm probably okay. So let's see. I haven't really used continuity very much. I've only used lower semi-continuity in S and upper semi-continuity in T. And since the norm on a Banach space is weakly lower semi-continuous and negative of the norm is weakly upper semi-continuous, I think that I'm probably okay, even if these are Banach spaces and these topologies are weak topologies. So this, which is strictly convex in S and strictly concave in T, and lower semi-continuous in S. Upper semi-continuous in T. And so the theorem, the proof that we just went through will apply to this thing perfectly well, and it will provide us with a Nash equilibrium. So there exists S epsilon T epsilon in S cross T such that P epsilon of F epsilon. P epsilon is bigger than P epsilon of S for all S. P epsilon, S epsilon T for all T. And less than P epsilon and so now somehow I want to take the limit of this statement and so in the finite dimensional context I have no trouble taking the limit. Okay, so a subsequence of the S epsilons, a subsequence. So compactness of S cross T implies a subsequence. S epsilon T epsilon converges to S0 T0. And so the hope is that as epsilon goes to 0, this will converge to P0 of S T0. And this will converge to P0 of S0 T. And this will converge to P0 of S0 T0. And when this thing, if I'm in a finite dimensional context, this thing is actually continuous, then this is jointly continuous, and then I'm done. So then I get this. If I do this, this guy here, then when I take, if this is only semi-continuous, when I take the limit as epsilon goes to 0, this might drop a little more, but that's okay. This might jump up a little bit, and that's also okay, and this guy is a little bit delicate. Yeah, okay. Well, so I see that this works in the finite dimensional case, and I don't quite see how to take this limit in the infinite dimensional case. That's about what I'm prepared to say about this. And okay, but let me tie this thing back to our Monge-Kantorovich problem. Claim that this thing can actually be put into the form of a two-player zero-sum game, and moreover, it's so it has all the geometry of this thing. It doesn't have all the topology. So it has the property that P is concave in the variable that it's supposed to be in and convex in the variable that it's supposed to be in, and the sets are convex. And then, so somehow the issue is that it doesn't quite fit the hypothesis, which I didn't quite manage to prove work in dimensions anyways. So the idea here is take P to depend on gamma and the pair of functions UV, and it should be something like integral of Cxy minus Ux minus dy d gamma plus integral of Ux du plus integral of Vy d nu and define this on the set F of all non-negative joint measures. And the set T of all the, it's very general, of all pairs of functions, U and V. And at least formally, this has the same structure. It's still a two-player zero-sum game. And if I do the inf sup of the P, so the inf over gamma in F, and the sup over U, V, and T, actually, let me do the other one first. Let me do the soup in first. Then somehow the idea is that if this integrand, these two terms don't depend on gamma at all. So when I'm taking the inf over gamma, if this integrand is negative at any point, I take gamma to have a large mass at that point, and the larger the mass of gamma I put at that point, the more negative this integral is, and so the integral will go to minus infinity. And so those functions u and v for which this integrand is negative somewhere have an inf of minus infinity and don't contribute to the sup at all. And so this is equivalent to the sup over all u and v and t such that the integrand is always positive, which is to say that u plus v is always less than c of y, inf of gamma bigger than 0, p of u gamma uv. And once you recognize this step, the integrand here is positive. The smallest I can make it with a non-negative measure gamma is by keeping gamma equal to 0, in which case this term doesn't contribute to the payoff at all. And then this is the sup overall uv less than c of just these two terms, what's left over. And on the other hand, if I compute the inf sup of this thing, let me notice that the payoff function can be rewritten as integral of the cost against gamma plus integral of u d mu of x minus d gamma xy. It's funny notation because I should really separate it into two integrals, which I'll do this time. And so when I take the supremum over V, either the right marginal of gamma is nu, or I can find some V such that this integral differs from this integral by either, so the difference is either a positive or a negative number. By taking V to be either a large positive or a large negative multiple of the original V, I can make this positive or negative number as large and positive as I choose. And so unless the right marginal of gamma is nu, this soup is going to be plus infinity. And similarly, unless the left marginal of gamma is nu, I'll be able to find a u which makes this integral arbitrarily large, and so the soup will again be plus infinity. And so this should be equal to an int over gamma positive and having marginals mu and nu, because when the supremum is plus infinity, it's not going to contribute to the int of the same expression. So still soup over uv and t e gamma uv. But once the marginal left marginal of gamma is mu, these two integrals should be the same and therefore should cancel each other out. And these two integrals, once the right marginal of gamma is nu, which I've assumed here, should be equal to each other and should therefore disappear. And so this should be equal to the nth of gamma of just this term here. And now the integrand doesn't depend on u and v at all. And so somehow the Kantorovich relation is exactly that the int soup, which is this thing, coincide with the soup int, which is this thing here. And it sort of has the right geometry to fall into the framework of this theorem in the sense that P is a bilinear function in gamma U and V. And these are both convex sets. It doesn't maybe have the right topology. And so somehow that's why one suffers a little bit to prove this. And well, we went through one case where you actually have to assume moment conditions on the mu and the nu in order to make sure everything converges the way you want it to. And then once you make those hypotheses, you get something like this out in the end. Other questions? So I guess that I will talk a little bit. I will kind of start from this. I'll talk a little bit about what the implications of this kind of duality are for general cost function C next week, and what kind of mappings you get between mu and nu, which are analogs of convex gradient maps, so the kinds of partial differential equations which come out as analogs of the Monge-Ampère equation. And I guess I should emphasize that most of what I said today is actually heuristic in the sense that it's just supposed to provide kind of some geometrical intuition into why something like this ought to be true and why we have the correct structure. And it doesn't fit together in the sense that it doesn't give a rigorous proof that something like this is true except under a lot of extra hypotheses like at least compact support for mu and nu and, yeah, so a lot of extra things that aren't taken into account.